Welcome to episode 23 of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. I'm James Stacey.
And I'm Jason Heaton. Before we get into today's main topic, James has some details on our holiday season giveaway. James, what's the deal?
We could take very little credit for this, but I am really excited. My pal and colleague at A Blog to Watch, Max, found himself in a pickle when he was gifted a second Seiko SRP diver. So because he's a good and generous dude and also a fan of kind of TGN's big love for Seiko divers, he wants to give away this spare watch to the TGN audience, which is amazing. So now we have our first giveaway. Oh, and also, this isn't some garden variety SRP 777. This is actually the Patty Edition SRP A21.
Awesome.
One of the most fun versions of our favorite watch of 2016. The rules for the giveaway are going to be super simple. At some point in this show, Jason is going to let you know a special code word, basically like an Instagram hashtag. Then we need you to go to Instagram and follow Max. He's at WatchMax, WATCHMAX, and our account at The Grey NATO. Sometime shortly after this episode, episode 23, goes live, we will put a specific giveaway post on the TGN account. Comment on that post by tagging one friend, we recommend like your favorite adventure buddy, and use that special code word hashtag that we'll tell you later in the episode, and you're entered for the giveaway. The giveaway will run until December 31st. There will be a huge worldwide countdown to mark the end of the giveaway, and also perhaps New Year's Eve. And we will select a winner and contact you on Instagram. Be sure you're following both accounts. So what an amazing giveaway. And Max, thank you so much for the generosity. And we can move on with the show. Be sure to stay tuned for your code word hashtag for Instagram.
Yeah, this is super exciting. So thanks a lot to Max, and good luck to all of our listeners out there with the contest. Moving on to today's main topic, we're going to do a third installment of the series that we have called the Collection Inspection, where James and I discuss a particular watch from our own collections. And previously, we've done two previous volumes of this being volume 3. James has talked previously about his Omega Seamaster Professional and his Helios Tropic, and I tackled my own Rolex Submariner and my Bremont Supermarine 2000. So today we've each picked a different watch about which we're going to wax poetic. James, which one did you pick for today?
I picked a watch not unlike my Seamaster, which had been in my collection for a long time. I picked a watch I've had for quite a few years now, the Bremont Solo. It's the 43mm, the white version. I got it around Christmas 2012. And that's the one I've got. What have you picked for today?
I guess we got sort of a pilot's watch theme going here for a couple of divers like we are. I've got the Oris Big Crown Pro Pilot Altimeter.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Watch, of course, I think we talked about it a little bit. I brought it to Vancouver for our TGN Summit over the summer. So, yeah, a couple of pilot's watches, pretty cool. I happen to really love your Solo. I mean, I know I saw it in person when I was in Vancouver, and I think I've seen it at Baselworld, but something about that white dial on that watch, it's every time I see a picture of it that you post on Instagram, it's just so striking. It's just such a minimalist, beautiful watch.
Yeah, it's kind of razor sharp, but it's very, like, aesthetically, maybe traditional is the word I want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it kind of has the same sort of razor sharpness as, like, a Pelagos, but not that kind of stark stop sign sort of aesthetic.
Yeah.
And at 43 millimeters, it's roughly my largest watch. Certainly the largest that I wear frequently. And I find that it's just kind of become my go-to big watch. It's super comfortable because, you know, I love the Bremont, the Triptych case.
Mm-hmm.
This is an early version of the white dial, which has a screw-down crown, which is a nice addition, not at all important for the way that I actually use or kind of kick around with the Solo. But, you know, the watch has been fantastic for quite a few years, and I've banged it into all sorts of stuff, and that hardened steel case really takes a scratch well. It looks really clean, and I really adore the dial. It's kind of a matte with a bit of a silver in it. It's a strange white. It's a very different white than my Explorer 2, and then of course you get kind of white metal. I think they might be white gold, but I don't remember specifically. You know, numerals and then kind of luminous elements at 12. 3, 6, and 9 in a date. I love the legibility. I think it looks great on a gray NATO, on a green NATO, leather strap.
White dials really take straps well, and you've certainly mounted it on quite a few. I think it's funny, when the Solo first came out, I can't remember what year they introduced that watch, but it just didn't do much for me. And, you know, since that time, my wife, Gishani, actually, she got the 37 millimeter version with the black dial, and she wears it fairly often. And
it's a great watch.
It's kind of risen to the top of the heap, close to the top of the heap for me when it comes to Braymont watches. I think it's, you know, it has that great, they kind of targeted this at that sort of IWC Mark series sort of aesthetic, you know, the classic pilot's watch, and yet they did it in a really original way, like I think Braymont just has a knack for doing. You know, they take these sort of classic forms, like the Supermarine with a dive watch, and the Solo with a pilot's watch, and they keep the aesthetic, but they kind of do it in their own way, and of course the build quality on these is always so good.
Yeah, I really like the finishing is relatively simple. You know, it's mostly brushed. You can actually now buy a polished version, the Solo / PW or PB, polished white dial, polished black dial. You know, I saw that at Basel last year, and certainly not to my taste.
Yeah.
Just because I loved brushed steel, and I really like the case, while, you know, straight on is quite simple from any angle, being the triptych case. It's actually, you know, it's nice. It's a three-piece case where the lugs are built into the top segment, which also kind of mounts the bezel, and then below that you have kind of the middle barrel, which on my Solo is a kind of black PVD. And then you have the case back, which is a display case back. You know, I wouldn't have paid extra to have the display case back. The movement they use, while it keeps fantastic time and has been very reliable for me, doesn't need to be seen, in my opinion. It's kind of like my Zen has a display case back. I just don't need it.
Yeah.
And I think with a pilot's watch, you could have kind of, that's a nice canvas for a cool design,
mm-hmm.
a steel, you know, the steel case back.
Yeah.
But yeah, they make, so this is a 43 millimeter version, and they make a 37, which you mentioned Gishani having, which is a very cool watch. My buddy Paul has one of those, which I think is really neat. And at that size, it really has a very, very much a vintage appeal, especially if you're used to wearing a big watch.
Right.
And then just last year, they announced the Solo 32, which is a specific ladies model. So it's a chronometer, but in 32 millimeters. It's also a very nice style. Certainly, again, Braymont's first specifically ladies line. So the Solo's kind of expanded. You have in the 43 millimeter side, you have the white and black in polished, the white and black in brushed. And then, of course, you have the Solo CR, which one is I've never actually seen in person, but that uses kind of a cream marker and hand.
Oh, I do like that one.
On a black dial, which I think would probably look really smart in person.
Yeah.
For me, it's all about the white dial. You know, I had seen, when I decided to buy this watch, I had been heavily weighing the S500, which is the first Braymont that I kind of borrowed from the brand for a review, and a watch that I still to this day really love. But, you know, I found it quite thick on wrist, and certainly with the, if you wear it with the bracelet, it's quite heavy. And when I saw the Solo, you know, I thought, oh, it's a black dial pilot's watch, it looks very nice. And then I saw the white one, and it's the way that the kind of polished markers really play with the light against the relatively matte back of the dial, and then you get some little bit of red accents at 12 and on the seconds hand.
Mm-hmm.
Lume is like a BGW9, so it's effective, but not like dive watch.
Yeah.
I'd love to see them grow this line. You know, you and I have talked about this a lot, and we always kind of, I always have my fingers crossed. I go to another Basel, will they do a GMT? I think it would be really cool to cross an MB2 with a Solo and then do the 12-hour bezel. Not unlike the kind of special edition they did with, I think it was Timeless.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But again, just maintain the white dial, the aesthetic of the white dial, which I think is so clean. And I find, you know, you can put this watch on, I have like an alligator leather strap.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to wear a blazer and a sweater and kind of do like more of a professor look, it still seems to work despite being kind of a big watch.
Yeah.
And then on a NATO, I mean, I've worn it, I've traveled to many, many places in the world with it as my go-to and current, you know, worn all day watch. It's very tough and easy to wear. It fits under a shirt cuff without too much trouble. And It's just a treat, you know.
I'm curious about the screw down crown because, you know, for one thing, I guess I'm curious how it came to be that the solo had a screw down crown at the beginning and then they went away from that, because so many of Bremont's don't have screw down crowns even from the beginning. I remember, you know, the Alt 1C and the, you know, the chronographs with the inner bezel and pretty much everything except the Supermarine series doesn't have a screw down crown. So I'm just curious, do you know the story behind that?
I don't know the backstory. Actually, you know, sometime after I bought the watch, I think there was a time where I was maybe the only guy kind of on Twitter and Instagram posting photos of it.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from, you know, Bremont's press images and such.
Yeah.
And a guy that I followed in the UK, he bought one and then wrote me, you know, hey, is yours a screw down? Mine's not. And then I think he reached out to Bremont and they said, yeah, the early ones were. And the later ones are, it doesn't affect the water resistance. And
yeah,
I don't think it would bother me if mine wasn't. But it's I guess it's kind of interesting that, you know, being an early one that it is. And, you know, as a kind of dive watch fan, you kind of have this mythos that you have to have a screw down crown.
Right. It's interesting, too, that you mentioned that this was your first White Dial watch. I wonder if it was a kind of a gateway watch
to
your Explorer 2, which of course is your other White Dial watch, which of course
is a beauty that we've talked about
before.
World Timer, which is exactly. I guess you would say the Seiko World Timer is like silver.
Yeah.
But on wrist in sunlight, it very much feels like you're wearing a white dial. I do like a white dial, and I think the Solo kind of kicked me out of a funk of pretty much just sticking to black dial watches with BGW9 or C3 markers, very much, you know, within the range of an SKX or something like that. And now I've got a Blue Tropic, I've got the World Timer, I've got a yellow Autodromo. So I guess, if maybe it was not only a kind of a kickoff point for liking and enjoying white dials, but also just more variety in general.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, it makes me think that I need a... I don't think I currently own a white dial watch, and every time I see them, I'm just so drawn to them. So yeah, need to correct that at some point.
Well, I think my favorite aesthetic element of my Explorer 2, which is the white one, the 16570 Polar, is the black surrounds.
Oh yeah,
on the markers and the hands. I absolutely adore it. I just think that on white is such an awesome look.
Yeah,
and the Solo, the white Solo, manages to copy some of that simply because the markers and hands have a polished face.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're not catching light, they look quite dark against a white background, the same way that like a polished hand or face disappears against a black background.
Right.
It actually stands out. It goes the opposite direction in with a white one. And when you combine that kind of element with what I would argue is one of the best crystals I've ever come across that's domed.
Yeah.
It you know, lots of watches can get away with a fantastic, you know, very anti-reflective flat crystal. I mean, mm-hmm. You look at my Zen 144 and you only know there's a crystal there because there's some little scratches in the AR.
Yeah.
Otherwise you can't see the crystal at all.
Yeah.
But with the Solo, it's a slightly domed crystal. And then it's something like, I'd have to go back and check my notes, but it's over a dozen layers of anti-reflective coating.
Oh, wow.
And each one is like hardened or polished.
Huh.
To really ensure like the best possible optical performance. They're really crazy about the crystal.
Yeah.
And you see that on the Supermarine because that has a fairly domed crystal. And you look at it and you go, there's no way that watch could be as anti-reflect, like that crystal could be as transparent as it is in photos.
Right.
Then you see it in person. It's just excellent.
Yeah. I love the Bremont domes, especially when you look at them from profile. They're just a perfect, just a ever so slight dome. But yeah, you're right. They're much more legible than so many other domed crystals I've seen.
Yeah, and I find that you get a really strong, legible face on the Solo in both the black and the white, but certainly the white just kind of uses that polished white metal marker and hand outline to its advantage as far as just pure contrast.
Yeah, it's a great watch, and we're, of course, we're both big fans of Bremont. I think a lot of times they do everything with sort of a wink. They're sort of they love the adventure aspect of watches, and sort of they respect the history of watches that are used for adventure, and I think that definitely appeals to me.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, it's been a great watch. You know, I bought the bracelet, and I know like on with your Auris, the strap is, you have to be kind of careful what you use as far as the strap because of the size of the watch.
Yeah.
And I actually can't explain why the bracelet for the Solo is fine. It's very nice. It's a nice steel bracelet. Relatively simple, but super sturdy and nicely made. But I'd like never wear it on the bracelet. Oh, yeah. It feels like it triples the weight of the watch, both visually and just the actual weight of the watch.
Yeah.
So it looks nice, especially with the white dial on a bracelet, always looks good, but it's too much. I really like the OEM brown leather strap. I commented recently on Instagram that the strap had held up so well over so many years. You know, it has a nice kind of curved edge that fits into the shape of the case and the lugs, but doesn't actually sit against the leather. Yeah. So it still looks like a leather strap should, like with that gap.
Yeah.
And it's just worked out well. It's very comfy. And the one that it came with was nice. I mean, I think if I was recommending somebody buy a Solo, I wouldn't tell them to go out and get the bracelet. It's great on the Temple Island, their rubber strap, and it's really good on the house leather. And, you know, it's a nice brown, kind of Breitling style brown leather strap with contrast stitching that matches the dial really nicely. And then really, you could even do away with all of those options and just wear it on a NATO because it's just very comfortable that way.
Yeah, I remember trying that that bracelet on my Supermarine 2000. And, like you said, it's certainly a high quality bracelet. But the aesthetic, it's that sort of, if I remember right, it's almost like a Speedmaster style with that little thin, which has never really been my favorite style. I'm just kind of a classic sort of three link guy. I don't know, for some reason, Braymont's worked really well on straps. And I think the Solo with that white dial and just all the elements that you talked about, just, it goes so well on, I don't know, anything I've seen you posted on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll be sure to get a few pictures of the watch up around when this episode comes out, but certainly there's tons in the history of my Instagram, and you can find my original review on a blog to watch. But let's take a look at this Pro Pilot altimeter. So this is a strangely complicated watch. It's a huge watch. I saw it in person. You brought it to Vancouver. It's really big.
It is.
It's
huge.
Big in every dimension.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's my biggest, heaviest watch. It's
for sure.
Massive.
I would say it's also fairly different from what you normally wear because it's quite modern in both its aesthetic and its technology and that sort of thing. So what kind of led you to even selecting that watch from, you know, Auris makes so many watches you could choose from, many, many great watches.
Yeah. It really wasn't on my radar much at all, though I did pay attention to it when it first came out, when the announcement came out, and I thought, neat idea. I mean, for those that maybe aren't familiar with this watch, the ProPilot altimeter, what really sets it apart is that it incorporates a mechanical altimeter within the watch case. So if I remember correctly, it's actually the first, to get hyperbolic about it, it was the world's first self-winding watch that incorporates a mechanical altimeter. Previously, I remember going to Basel when that brand Breva, which is a very small brand, introduced a couple of watches that had an altimeter in them that used this sort of similar concept of barometric pressure used to tell altitude. But those watches were extremely expensive, for one thing, like really, really expensive. And they were hand-wound, in-house movement, you know, all sorts of things. So this is just a whole different animal. These watches are somewhere between, $3,000 and $5,000. I can't remember what I paid for this, but much more reasonably priced than Breva was. And apparently the world's first automatic watch with an altimeter in it. And going back to what attracted me to it, I've always liked Auris as a brand, and I've always liked their Pilot's watches. And this one carries forward a lot of the aesthetics that the rest of the Big Crown Pro Pilot family has. It has these sort of radially knurled band around the bezel. The crown is really deeply fluted.
The bezel looks really cool.
It has this vaguely... I guess what I really like about it is, as much as you and I are both divers or whatever, I'm at heart, I'm really kind of an aviation geek. I've always loved, jets, fighter jets, flying, planes, pilots, all that kind of the gear and all that that goes along with it. And I think what Auris did with this watch is they somehow captured that in a watch. It's kind of like what we talked about in our last episode about the Autodromo Group B, where Autodromo really captured that sense of rally racing in the 1980s in a watch without being overly literal about it. And I think Auris kind of has accomplished the same thing with this watch, where you get this radial knurling around the bezel, these big crowns, you know, without any sort of goofy, overly literal logos or, you know, airplane shaped this or that, or propellers for seconds hands or any goofiness like that. I think it just looks like a tool. And I first got a chance to try out this watch because Auris had invited me on a press trip a couple of years ago to Ambry, Switzerland, where they do an annual fly-in, and they do some really great flights where people can go up with a number of different airplanes.
I've seen pictures. It just looks unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful setting. Ambry is in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland, kind of in the south, and they do this annual fly-in that Auris sponsors. And when I was there, I was lucky enough to be one of the people that was selected to fly in a Hawker Hunter, which is it was built in the 50s and 60s and 70s. It's a British plane that was used by the Swiss Air Force. And it's a legitimate Cold War era fighter jet that I think it's subsonic, but nevertheless, it's just a really cool fighter jet. And so I got to go on a flight in this jet off this little airstrip amidst all these beautiful mountains. And they lent me this ProPilot altimeter to wear, just for the few days that I was there. And, you know, it was under the auspices of testing it. And certainly I probably glanced at my wrist a couple of times while I was up on the flight. But, you know, let's face it, I was more enthralled with the flight itself than the watch. But
for sure,
I don't know, somehow being on that trip with that watch sort of imbued it's sort of like a smell reminds you of a place, and I think that the watch sort of reminds me of that trip and reminds me of that experience, and it sort of embedded that sense of adventure and flying and just that whole experience. And so I think it kind of endeared me to the watch, and after the trip I bought one, and I wear it quite a bit. Having said all this about flying and aviation and pilot's watches, this watch actually, I think, works much better as sort of a sports watch, an all-around sports watch. You and I took it on our hike up to St. Mark's when I was in Vancouver for the TGN Summit over the summer. And since then, I also took it to Colorado and did some hiking in the mountains in the Rockies there. And it's remarkably accurate and, you know, as it should be. I mean, mechanical altimeters have been around a lot longer than the digital ones we find in like Suntos and Garmins and things, but it works really well as a hiking watch. I mean, if you're in an airplane, chances are you're in a pressurized capsule. You're not going to get a true reading of altitude, and I'm guessing most pilots aren't glancing at their wrist when they're flying, you know, for altitude reading. So
yeah.
Even though it has this pilot-y sort of vibe to it, I find it works really well as just kind of a cool watch to wear in the mountains.
Yeah, no doubt. I think it. I mean, it certainly looked at home hiking around in the mist of the Pacific Northwest when you're here. And it's the dial has like a fantastic kind of three-dimensionality to it because of the, you know, kind of how recessed the indication for the altitude is along the kind of circumference of the dial.
Yeah, I mean, the construction of this watch is really interesting because what they've done is they've sort of suspended the mechanical automatic watch movement, which I think is a Sellita movement. Sort of in a bowl almost that rides or is suspended above a bowl on which the needle for the altimeter spins. And then the altimeter unit is actually in the bottom of the watch case, which you're right. It lends this incredible detail. There's a lot of numbers going on in the dial. I mean, the entire outer track is the altitude track. And then you get this like valley in between, this cutout section where the altimeter needle spins and then the watch dial's in the middle. And yet it all really remains remarkably legible for as busy, I guess, as it is.
And being, you know, 47 millimeters and some 18 millimeters tall, I mean, you have a big wrist. It's not like it looks crazy or anything. It looks fine, but how do you wear it? How do you find that it's most comfortable? Does it work on a NATO, something that big?
Well, So the strap it came on is really awesome. And I think it's the same strap that they also use on a lot of the other Pro Pilots. It's a sort of a woven textile that's backed with leather. And then it comes with a really cool deployant clasp that, it's a fold-over clasp, but the way that you release it is very much like, and it's modeled after an airplane seatbelt buckle. So you kind of you get your fingernail under it, and then you just pull it up, and it comes loose. And it even says, lift, like at the little section where you lift it. Which, having said what I said earlier about them not getting too gimmicky, that's probably as close as it comes. But I don't think it's over the top, and I think it was clever. It works really well, and the strap looks really good. They sell two versions of the strap. It comes in like a drab olive, and then I've got the. It's sort of a silvery gray, but this textile color, it's that notion of capturing sort of an aviation vibe without being too literal. And I can't quite put my finger on what that textile reminds me of, but the strap is great. The unfortunate thing is that the fact that it's backed with leather doesn't make it great for hiking and things like that for too much, because it's, if you get sweaty and stuff, you probably would ruin the leather. I've tried it on NATO. It's just way too... It's way too big. It's way too heavy to wear on NATO. But
yeah,
currently,
for sure.
I've got it on a. It's actually the strap that came on my Supermarine 2000, my Bremont. It's the one that Bremont sells with several of their watches. It's a I don't want to call it a NATO style, but it's kind of a one piece strap that has a loop on one end and then the Velcro that loops through it on the other end.
Oh sure, I think they call it their Zulu.
Yeah. So originally Bremont was getting it made by Carl Evans over at Gas Gas Bones, and then I think he ran into some sort of volume issues and it was outsourced somewhere else for a while, but I think he's back to making them for Bremont, and I'm not sure which version I have here, but it works really, really well on this watch. I think it fits it nicely. It's a good balance for just the heft of the watch, so that's working for me at this point. But I noticed on their website, actually, that they sell this version with a bracelet, which I think would just make it incredibly heavy.
And they also announced a new version recently, didn't they?
Yeah, so I was looking at their website for kind of some specs and things in preparation for today's show, and, they still sell the same two versions that they always have, which is one that comes in with a feet scale and one with a metric scale. But then I noticed that they have a third version now. I think it's sort of a limited commemorative edition that pays tribute to like a Swiss mountain rescue team or something like that.
See, I mean, the new one kind of looks like all the other ones, but it has like a little Swiss flag on the dial, and then it's a PVD coating, kind of a medium dark black.
Yeah, and I think it works. It looks really different than the others.
Yeah, I think it looks really cool.
It's really cool. It gives it a more of a kind of a tactical look to it.
Yeah, and it works well with that like hyper, aviation gauge. Sort of, I think of all the Pro Pilots, because of that altimeter, it looks so much like a piece of aviation equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's just kind of pulled right off of the, dash of some plane and then minimized a bit.
Yeah.
And do you know roughly what the price point is? I'm wondering if maybe it's within the same, I think it must be within the same vein as the Solo.
Yeah, I think both our watches today come in right around 3,800, just below 4,000. Is that about what the Solo is as well?
I actually don't know what the current price is on the Solo. When I reviewed it for a blog to watch, it was, 4,100 USD.
Okay.
So my guess is in that 4 years, it's gone up a couple hundred bucks. If I were to really wager, I'd say probably 4,395, something like that.
Sure.
Plus or minus the bracelet. What they actually sell for in the store, I don't know. I don't know like what the retail kind of discounting experience would be on either an Oris or a Bremont.
Yeah.
Certainly you can buy Bremont stuff and probably Oris too on like cruises.
Right.
And then you're not paying taxes. That's got to be a great way to buy the watch.
Yeah.
Or at least a great way if you already know the watch you're looking for.
Yeah.
But I've seen, Mike, the guy that runs Bremont for the U.S., I've seen him on various cruises, so I know that they must move some watches that way, which is a pretty attractive way to buy like a luxury good, because you do pay a handful in tax, or at least you would as a Canadian.
Yeah,
I'm not, I'm assuming you would as in the States as well.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's definitely a viable, great way to buy these things. I've certainly trolled the duty free shops when I've been traveling, and it is a good way to do it. regardless, I mean, $3,800 for this ProPilot is pretty impressive for what you get in this watch.
You're not going to find something like it for...
Exactly, yeah.
Similar.
And I think...
I mean, like, it's one of the rare watches a watch reviewer could go out of their way and say, like, oh, this is a fairly unique watch.
Yeah, and whenever I wear this, you know, everybody kind of knows, not everybody, but, you know, a lot of people in the watch enthusiast community, I guess, know Oris. But Oris has this real knack for just keeping price points low while creating pretty interesting watches. I mean, that dive watch with the depth gauge was really innovative, and that's pretty inexpensive as well. You know, you can get the really great dive watches from Oris for, geez, I think you can get them for, you know, not much more than $1,000 in some cases, but they're great. And whenever I wear this watch, it's like driving a really fun convertible or something. Like, it just kind of brings a smile to people's faces. People get curious. They look at it. It has just enough kind of interest to it. You know, it's got little splashes of red and yellow. Of course, there's the whole backstory and kind of the technology behind it. So I wear it quite a bit, and it's a watch that it's just fun to wear. I mean, it's not practical. It's not something that fits under a shirt sleeve by any means, but it's a blast. I love it.
Great watch. Really, really cool choice. And, you know, I think that basically wraps up Collection Inspection Volume 3. We brought a couple Pilot's watches out of the watch case, and I think both are great watches, and I kind of see how both kind of suit our taste in other watches as well, like with mine with the white dial and such, and yours with kind of the crazy complication. And then, of course, you've got your Emergency 2, and it's kind of a big toolish, pilot-y sort of sports watch. And, you know, I think that's well within the vein of your kind of collecting sphere.
Yeah, we tend to not stray too far from our, I guess, our core values, I guess, so to speak.
Don't I know it. We'll get into dress watches in a few years, have to start up a different podcast.
Yeah, right. The gray flannel suit, we'll call it.
The gray crocodile strap.
Yeah, right.
So yeah, if you have any experience with a Braymont Solo or an Oris ProPilot, whatever, or you have a question about either of these watches and now you know that one of us has one, please, thegraynato@gmail.com, send us your questions. I reply to every single email, and the ones that I'm too swamped or too frazzled to reply to, I forward to Jason. So that's the way that works, and please send us your questions if you've got them. We'll be back in just a moment with some new business.
Okay, so it's time for new business, but before we get into things, let me tell you the code word that James mentioned earlier in the show for our holiday giveaway. And that code word is... WatchMaxTGN. So WATCHMAXTGN. And if you put the hashtag in front of it in your Instagram post, we will be able to find it. So WatchMaxTGN. James, what's new in your world?
Oh man, so I went down a rabbit hole on flashlights. So I guarantee that a lot of the guys, and theoretically some women, that listen to TGN know a lot about flashlights, but it's something that I only ever have dabbled in long enough to find one that I like, and then I quickly back out. Because it is one of these like slippery slope hobbies where you're like, oh, this $40 flashlight's so much better than the $10 I got at that work gave me as a gift, or that somebody gave me for, you know, it uses two AA's or plugs into a USB, and then before you know it, 40 is like, oh, I really need this one made by a guy in Ohio, and he mills the case by hand. And then you're into like the Chris Reeves things with the knife, and you're buying a $400 flashlight. And I know that I'm that person that does that.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew I wanted a brighter flashlight that was USB rechargeable. And even if it just had like okay reviews, that was fine by me, because I don't like use a flashlight all the time. I'm not like in search and rescue or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to have one that, like, I could throw in a bag when I go to Basel. You walk into an Airbnb and it's pitch black, or you're trying to find that stupid Swiss power port somewhere around your room, and just something like that, and that wasn't too big, but also not like a keychain size thing.
Yeah.
So I dug around, and I almost bought some stuff from 47s, and I almost bought some stuff from Mech Army. And then I came across these reviews for kind of a Chinese-made light called the Zanflare F1. It's made by a company called GearBest, which is like, if you imagine an Amazon for random semi-random tech items out of China.
Yeah.
That's kind of what GearBest is. You know, I bought a Mi Band, a Xiaomi Mi Band, it's like a fitness tracker from them. So that's the only reason I knew GearBest. But the Zanflare is kind of their swing at copying the best elements of these more expensive flashlights and kind of building them into something that they offer for a much lesser price.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that when I came across the page, it was also in a pre-Black Friday sale if enough people bought it. And enough people had already bought this light, so it was like, I think I got it for $30.
Oh, wow.
And so, I mean, it's super powerful. It's not too big. It's a nice kind of simple black metal flashlight. It's an aluminum body. So, yeah, I got it for 25% off. It's on for $40 right now. Max output with the correct battery is 1,240 lumens.
Wow.
Which is 3x what my dive lamp does at 400.
Yeah.
And then it has kind of a tail switch and a thumb switch to take you through the modes. So there's kind of a nice way of controlling, because there's variable brightness. Some of these rechargeable lights, you have to take the light apart to get to the rechargeable part, like where the port is for the USB cable.
Yeah.
This has a ring about mid flashlight that you unscrew and it just uncovers.
Oh, very cool.
The port and the ring is gasketed on both sides.
Wow.
And it uses a aluminum body, and it has a charge indicator and it'll remember the last brightness you had it on via the tail switch.
Wow.
So it'll kind of jump back and forth to the way you want to use it. And yeah, it does something like 1,240 lumens and then ramps down when the light starts to heat up. So you get 30 seconds or something at that brightness, and it brings it down to, I guess, a more reasonable 500. And I'm currently borrowing a flashlight from a buddy that does 220 lumens.
Yeah.
This kind of nice model from Phoenix called the E35. And Phoenix has upgraded models of the E35, which are, I think, in many ways what the Zanflare is copying. You know, this is kind of your traditional pocket-sized flashlight. It's maybe 4 or 5 inches long and maybe a roll of nickels around. And it works really well at 220 lumens. So I think the 1,240 is, I guess if you wanted to blind someone.
Oh, sure.
Signal an aircraft. I'm not sure. But, you know, that flexibility is nice. And certainly the rechargeability is kind of key for what I wanted. And all the kind of flashlight forums had various reviews of them, and people seem to really dig them. So I've got one of those coming in the mail, and then a couple batteries from eBay. So I'm not sure you want to talk more about flashlights, but that's what I use. I mean, do you have a flashlight that you love, or are we closet flashlight guys? I don't know.
Well, I didn't think I was, but you know, when you were talking about it, I was thinking about this collection of lights that I have, and most of them are you know, dive lights. And when I came to Vancouver and we were diving there, I brought my probably my best light, which is a Light and Motion Sola 800, which is
they're just so much fun to use.
Yeah, I mean, they're bomb-proof, you know, underwater lights that you can use as a video light or just as a regular hand torch for looking for octopus and stuff like that. But you know, I've got kind of a cool Hollis LED 3 that I use for diving, kind of a smaller one, and then kind of the two that you can use topside that are probably not the brightest ones are also Light and Motion, and they're called the Gobi lights, and they're really kind of quirky lights. They have kind of a weird target market because Light and Motion does bike lights and they also do dive lights, and this is sort of the merging of the two. So these, you can carry them in your hand like small flashlights, but then they have mounts that you can put on like arms for diving, for like putting on a tray with a camera.
Okay.
Or they have like mounts for mounting to like a bicycle handlebar or your helmet. And I think they're like 600 or 700 lumens.
Yeah, it looks like they run between 500 and 850, depending on the lamp.
Yeah, and then you can get spot or flood lenses for them. So they're pretty versatile lights. I don't use them much, but they're you've kind of inspired me to dig them out and charge them up, because they've they're really sturdy. They're really versatile. They're very light. And I should use them. I think when I got them, I thought, oh, these are dive lights, but, I think they'd have some good use topside as well. And I like your idea of tucking a small one in a bag. Maybe it's not the Gobi. Maybe I need to start, heading down that rabbit hole that you went down and pick up a nice small flashlight that
I'll send you a Zanflare F1 the next time it's on sale.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously.
We'll just be blinding people around the streets of Geneva. those cold walks home from a meeting or something.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, I find it pretty handy. Like I often have the, use the LED on my phone.
Oh yeah.
To do a little bit. And then you realize just how much nicer it is when I'll grab a headlamp, which is typically my go-to flashlight around the house is a headlamp. You know, you're fixing something under a sink.
Right.
Or you're digging through a pile of something in a storage locker and you really want to be able to see what you're going for. I love a good headlamp, but we'll see what I get out of this. Maybe it was $40 with the battery, you know, not well spent. But I'll report back in case anyone's interested. And, of course, we'll include links in the show notes.
Yeah.
And how about you? You just came back from some diving. How was all of that? Good trip?
It was a good trip. You know, it kind of incorporates a lot of what we do. We talk about a new business because it was an experience. But then I also got a chance to test out some new gear. My wife and I were in Bonaire, which is one of our favorite places. I've probably talked about it before on the show.
For sure.
It's down in the Southern Caribbean. And we were there for a full week kind of over the Thanksgiving week here in the U.S. And we were there to do a kind of a commercial photo shoot for a company called Deep Blue that makes digital dive computers. And they had sent along five different color versions of this new dive computer that they've come out with called the Cosmic Plus, which is a computer I think we talked about quite a while ago. I think that was in new business probably back in the summer. But I finally got a chance to dive with these computers down there. We did about 15 or 16 dives over 6 days, all shore diving. So there were no boat charters involved, which is really what I think is the beauty of Bonaire. Is it's one of these, you know, great Southern Caribbean spots with really healthy reefs. But what makes it fun is that you just rent a pickup truck and drive up and down the coast with tanks in the back and throw them on your back whenever you find a good spot on the beach and wade into the water, swim out to the reef and dive as long as you've got air. And so we just did a lot of that. We took a lot of photos. I think Gashani took 1,700 photos of which we have to weed down to somewhere between 20 and 30 for delivery. So, you know, it was a lot of work. Most of our diving was to take photos of this these new dive computers, which I'll say I'm quite impressed with these dive computers. The Cosmic Plus, the cool thing about them is, you know, it's a pretty competitive field when it comes to dive computers, and it's pretty bold of a small company in Taiwan to try to kind of reinvent the wheel. But what they've done is they've made this computer, you know, it's digital. It's got a big bright digital display. All the functions, all the settings are set through via Bluetooth, via an app on your phone. So you set up, you know, whether you want feet or meters, the time of day, how conservative you want the computer to track your dive.
The algorithm, sure.
The algorithm that it uses. You know, there's a number of settings that you kind of dial in via the phone app.
If you've, like you and I know, like I use a dive with a Suunto Zoop. And to change those settings on the Zoop,
yeah,
you know, you're kind of mashing these buttons that aren't exactly, you know, they don't give you any tactile feedback.
Yeah.
And you're trying to figure out going, you know, it's nested menus, so you're going back and forwards through menus to try and find everything to get it the way you want. And you can change the algorithm on a Zoop. I think it's 1, 2, or 3. And, you know, in terms of level of conservatism and of course, when you go back to get your dive logs to write it down, that's a pain because then you have that kind of plastic guard that protects the screen is all fogged up. So you're having trouble figuring out, am I in the menu? Am I in the log?
Right.
I imagine that this is a pretty refreshing experience where you just kind of do what you normally do and flip through your phone and get everything the way you want it.
Yeah, it feels very modern. It feels like next generation because I've dived with the Zoop or the previous version, which was called the Gecko, for many, many years. And it took a little bit of getting used to, but the Cosmic, you know, the setting on the phone is nice, but then what happens is when you get it on your wrist, the display is really bright, works really well in especially in darker conditions. It's a little hard to read in really bright daylight, but even kind of toggling through the menus on the computer itself was really simple to kind of put it in nitrox mode and dial in the percentage of oxygen that you've got in your mix.
Cool.
Yeah, the safety stop countdown, it has this feature that I just wish Suunto, I mean, they should just do it. It counts down minutes and seconds. So if you remember your Zoop, it's like you go on a 3-minute safety stop and it's like 3, 2, or 1 minute. And you're like, you have no idea where you are. And this thing just counts down. It's like starts at 3 minutes and 2:59, 2:58, 2:57. And you can just watch it. And
that 3-minute countdown on a really cold dive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you have to stop moving roughly. For the safety stop, or at least limit your movements, and you can feel the blood start to cool in your hands and your your arms and your feet, and you're just like, oh, I really hope that 3 becomes a 2 soon.
Yeah. So there are a lot of things I really liked about it. It's got kind of a neat NATO style Velcro strap, kind of not unlike the Bremont one that I was telling you I have on my Aorus right now. So you know, really a fun. A fun way to kind of test them out and take.
And
a lot
do they
of
charge on USB?
Yeah, so it's a USB charger with a magnetic attachment.
Oh, okay.
So
no little like rubbery flap that's going to
float. No, that's great.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, just sticks to the back.
How many dives for or minutes diving for battery life or?
So, I think I got. So when it's fully charged, I think I got about two full days of diving off of it. So you know, roughly 5 or 6 dives.
Enough for any normal person to go out for a day and then charge it that night.
Totally. Now I haven't.
Very good. Cool.
I haven't tried it on the cold dives like Great Lakes or up where you are. So I'd love to try it out there. But so far so good. It was cool to try. And then on my other wrist while we were down there, I had the Unimatic Modelo Uno, which is a watch that we talked about. In our last episode,
I saw some photos. It looked great.
Great, you know, it was funny to have this ultra high tech modern dive computer on one wrist, and then this really minimalist retro no date, dive watch with a bezel that just has like a zero marker, just a little pip and no numerals on the other wrist. It was quite the stark contrast, but it was fun. You know, I mean, as you know, when you wear a good dive watch. Diving, you really hardly even notice it. It kind of wears well, doesn't snag on stuff, easy to read, and held up well all week. It was really fun to wear. So I'm going to be doing a review on Hodinkee of that Unimatic. So maybe by the time this episode airs, we'll have that up or within a few days of it. So
very cool. Looking forward to reading it.
And then the final bit of new gear that I was trying out on this trip, I for years, almost since the beginning of my diving career, I've dived with these fins called Force Fins, which is from a kind of a quirky small company in California that custom molds almost pairs per order, to order when you order them. And they're kind of funky frog looking short little fins that I've loved for years. But my wife/photographer was hoping that she could get some fins on me that would show up a little bit better in photos, maybe get a little color. So I kind of scouted around and read some reviews, and I picked up a pair of Scuba Pro Twin Jet Max fins in bright yellow.
Nice.
And I was a little skeptical because the advantage of the Force fins is they're small and fairly light, but they have a completely open foot pocket in the front. So, you're not only your toes, you can wiggle your toes, but almost the entire front of your foot is free, so it really eliminates any issues with cramping while you're diving. So I was kind of worried about going to a fin that is a little bit more closed at the front, but I had no issues. The Scuba Pros were wonderful, great power, slightly positively buoyant, which is different than the Force fins, which kind of always had my feet sinking if I was just sort of hovering.
Sure.
And the spring straps, easy to pull on and off. I loved them. They're great.
Cool. Yeah, really nice.
It was a good week. We did, mostly reef diving. We did a couple of dives on a wreck there. And, like I said, just...
Any wildlife highlights?
Bonaire is all about kind of the smaller stuff. You don't really get many big things. I mean, we saw a few turtles. We saw, you get cuttlefish there.
Awesome.
You get, I don't think we saw an octopus on this trip. But you get like flounders and scorpion fish and lionfish, which are invasive down there, but they're still kind of fun to see. But, you know, I spend so much time posing with this stupid computer on my wrist that you just don't get much time to be looking. There could have been a whale shark behind me for all I knew.
Yeah, I guess it's not tourist diving when you've got it, because it's so much work to shoot underwater.
Yeah.
And you have to get coverage, otherwise you'd start all over again on the next dive.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that makes sense. And you can blow a huge amount of time and gas.
Yeah.
Just kind of holding your position.
Yeah.
For the lights and the camera and such. But yeah. That's really cool. I'm jealous. You know, I haven't been in the water for a while. Certainly not tropical. I was just looking at my images from a year ago, you know, Google photos, like, hey, look what you were doing a year ago. And I was diving in Mexico with the Pelagos and the Halios Delphin and the Oris 65. And
nice.
Yeah, I would love to be doing a little warm water diving. So that's great. I'm definitely jealous, and I'll be less jealous when your winter returns, but
well, it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, no doubt. You feeling some final notes?
Yeah, let's move on.
Cool. So I'll kick this off. I've got my first one is a post by a guy, auto writer Zach Bowman. He and another guy whose name you may recognize if you've been into cars for a while, Alex Roy, went and drove the LA to NYC, the Cannonball route, roughly 2,900 miles in a Morgan three-wheeler.
Oh, jeez. Oh.
Which is, you know, a car that's basically, they're still making like it was 1945 or 1940, I suppose. And the title, so this is on thedrive.com, fantastic car website that's popped up. It's where Alex Roy does all his writing, and I've enjoyed, really, really enjoyed all of his recent posts. But his co-driver for this endeavor, Zach Bowman, wrote a great piece called "I Set the LA to NY Record in a Morgan Three-Wheeler," and then the byline is, "And it was absolutely terrible."
I can imagine.
So this is a car that's like barely room for two people to sit in it. I mean, you would drive it for 20 minutes and feel like you probably aged a couple years.
Mm.
And these guys drove it across country, and I won't say the time. It's in the post. And then, of course, for those of you who know who Alex Roy is, he at one time held the all-time record for NYC to LA, the kind of Brock Yates Cannonball, in a highly modified BMW M5 at 31 hours, 4 minutes. Wow. And a couple years ago, a guy beat that time and actually came in, I believe, at 29 hours, 51 minutes, I want to say. And so, I mean, this is all done. There's like a kind of secret society that curates people claiming to have done this. The kind of, you know, so originally the Cannonball, if I have my facts straight, the Cannonball was set up by a guy named Brock Yates to protest the onslaught of speed limits across the highway system of the U.S.
Hmm.
And his plan was to show that you could drive at ridiculous speeds safely across these great roads. And so they did it a number of times, and it's where you also get, what was the movie with...
Burt Reynolds,
a Cannonball Run. Is kind of, that kind of makes more of a joke out of the whole thing, but certainly if you go back and read up on Brock Yates, if you're interested in it, and then that record kind of sat dormant for a long time, and then Alex Roy was involved with some of the early Gumball rally stuff before it was maybe as bro-y and rich guy as it's become.
Yeah.
And then took his, this really nice E39 M5 that's full of all sorts of tech and an additional, you know, gas tank. It's modified to go very long distances at very high speeds and do its best to avoid police detection, and set his time 31 hours, 4 minutes. He wrote a book. I believe there was a documentary when the statute of limitations for basically all the GPS records would show you how fast you are, where you're going, and when.
Yeah.
So they had to make sure that all of that had kind of cleared before they talked too much about it. And he's since then done the run. He holds the record for a Tesla as well, and now the record for an open-top vehicle, a three-wheel vehicle, and I guess specifically a Morgan three-wheeler. So, I guess you could modify Ariel Adam or something and try and catch their time, but really crazy, and when you read this post, it's bonkers how terrible it sounds.
It sounds horrible, but I even think that trip, trying to set a record, I mean, that's a long drive, and even you know, even the even earlier records at, you know, roughly 30 hours, that's such an insane time to do that number of miles.
Yeah, I think you start, I think you break into the respect area if you have a very fast car and you come in under 40 hours.
Wow.
But yeah, so it's basically you need a, you need the better gas tank, you need a, you need to know your route very well.
Yeah.
And then you get into the legal issues of, like, you have to know what states have reciprocity with your license.
Oh.
So it's preferable to have a license from a state that doesn't have reciprocity, so you'll just pay the money.
Oh.
But of course, if you're talking about, and I don't condone any of this, but not that it matters one way or another, people are going to do it. Some of these guys going 160 miles an hour.
Oh, sure.
They're not giving you a fine for that in any state, I assume. They just take the car.
Yeah.
Or at least send you to jail. So, I mean, you have to be kind of smart about it. And certainly in the old days of Cannonball Run and some of the other kind of cross-country races that popped up or coastal races that popped up in its wake, people were using spotting planes.
Oh, wow.
And dummy cars, sending cars out ahead, things like that. Lots of radio contact. And now technology can help a lot with that. And certain states allow you to use all those various technologies. So it's just a question of how legal do you want to go to kind of chase this dream of the 70s and road, you know, illegal road races and things like that. And this is technically you're not racing anybody except the clock, which maybe is just as crazy. I don't know. But yeah, it's certainly he's done it in a Tesla, something like 90%+ of it on autopilot.
Oh, wow.
Bonkers.
Oh,
yeah, really cool. Like, he was trying to prove a point that that autopilot was better than the average driver.
Wow.
Certainly better than the average driver. And now in a three-wheeler. And, I mean, please, please go read Zach Bowman's piece, because it's funny, but it's also, like, I drew comparisons to reading about people, you know, climbing mountains.
Yeah.
Where every moment is just pure misery, and then they start to get close to the end or the top or whatever, and you start to feel giddy and, like, kind of you're losing your mind at certain points and you're remembering things you've never thought about before because your brain is so bored.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a funny and kind of, it's beautifully written, the post. So check that out. That's kind of my first share for the week. Jason, you've got a long read or two for us as well, don't you?
Yeah. I've got two long reads, for my, final notes this week. The first is, it was a really cool long-form article that was written by a guy named James Nestor, who I had heard of previously because he's the author of a great book called Deep, which was about freediving. I encourage anybody to check that book out. But this article is called Unfathomable, and it really focused on this bit of history that I wasn't aware of, although I'd heard of the names of the people involved. It was kind of about the origins of hard hat salvage diving, which really came about because of a number of circumstances. But basically, there was a shipwreck in England. It was kind of a warship that sank just outside of a harbor in fairly shallow water by kind of our divers' terms, about 80 feet deep. But in those days, it was, you know, pretty well inaccessible to anybody, but it had a lot of very valuable stuff on board that you know the government really was eager to get back. And so these two brothers, Charles and John Dean, kind of put their heads together and came up with this idea to use like a brass helmet mated to a canvas suit one of the brothers had invented for use by firefighters that never really caught on. And they suddenly had this brainstorm that we could use this to do underwater salvage work by, you know, attaching an air hose to it and pumping compressed air. And so they did all these weird experiments, like, I don't know if it was like in the Thames River or, you know, somewhere where they were just testing out this system. And ultimately it worked. And, you know, as the story goes, they kind of made great wealth and whatever by salvaging not only this wreck, but they became kind of the go-to guys for salvaging shipwrecks back in the 1780s and 90s. But beyond kind of that historical element, it's kind of a fascinating piece about the relationship between the two brothers and kind of their rise and fall of their fortune and fame and kind of what their good fortune did to their relationship with each other, how it affected their lives. And it reads like it's almost Shakespearean in a way. And it kind of marries this great historical diving piece with kind of this very human story about these two brothers. So again, great story. It's called Unfathomable, and it was part of on a website called Epic Magazine, which I hadn't heard of before, but the format is really cool. It's done in a really nice kind of scrolling digital format with some great visuals and animations that is really kind of worthy of reading on a computer, which, a lot of online articles, I'd almost just rather read them in a paper magazine or something. Yeah. But this works really well in this format. So we'll throw a link in the show notes and you really should check it out. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that yet, James.
A couple people, you included sent me the link and I clicked on it and I thought that the title was exciting. And then I saw the visual and then I started to scroll to get a quick idea of how long it was. And I was like, oh, this is intimidating. And it's still in pocket, so I will read it.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten to it yet, unfortunately. And now listening to you kind of summarize it, I'm kicking myself because it sounds really cool. I'm excited to read it either way. So
yeah, good stuff.
So yeah, keeping in tune with the diving and the kind of construction and the engineering side and the development of new technologies and that sort of thing. My next final note is from the Rolex Presents series on YouTube, which is just at their the Rolex channel, but this is about the Trieste's deep dive, and then you want the one that's in parenthesis extended. So it is 22 and a half minutes long. One of our listeners recommended this to me in email, and then I could not for the life of me find the email today to give them credit. So I'm really sorry. I know that I replied to the email. I then watched the video, loved it, and wanted to put it in final notes, and I cannot give you credit for sending it to me. So if you can just send me another email, I'll get you some credit in a further show. But I've really loved this video. It's essentially just a kind of medium-length documentary about the Trieste and about Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard, who, traveled to Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench. Just fantastic. I mean, there's not a lot to talk about. I think a lot of people know the rough story. But Rolex is, of course, very tied to that, and they've produced this lovely, very watchable, if you've got a lunch break or you're just trying to not think about work for a little while, pull this up and even watch it in two parts or whatever with a coffee in the morning. It's great. I loved it.
Yeah, it's a really great video, James. And just, going back to who sent it, it was actually an email that was sent to me by Alan Clark, who is based in Switzerland, actually. So, Alan, thanks a lot for the recommendation.
Great choice, Alan. Really, really loved the video. And I actually found a handful of other really cool videos on their Rolex channel. So get on there, subscribe, and kill some time someday. Jason, you've got another for us, right?
Yeah, I've got one more long read. This one, aviation related. You and I have kind of geeked out over that cliffhanger series that was the Outside podcast about the plane crash in the mountains.
So good.
Down in South America. This one is an article called The Human Factor. It was actually from 2014, so it's a little bit older, but it's definitely worth digging up and reading. It was written by this famous aviation expert and author named William Langewiesche. And what he does in this article, and it's a really long article, so be sure to set aside a good amount of time or save it, download it for a plane trip or something. Well, you might not want to read it on a plane trip.
Yeah, I suppose not.
It really takes a deep look into the factors that caused the crash of the Air France Flight 447 that was en route from Brazil to Paris and ended up crashing in the middle of the Atlantic. What Langewiesche does is he looks at the flight recorder and the cockpit voice recorder and kind of almost goes minute by minute during the crisis that led to the crash and analyzes the pilot's communication, what was happening to the aircraft, and then using that as sort of a vehicle to discuss what has become of piloting in an era of what they call nowadays the glass cockpit, which is this sort of, planes have changed. Airbus and Boeing have created this cockpit environment where pilots are no longer flipping switches and looking at, you know, electrical and mechanical gauges, but they're actually almost looking at iPad screens and,
sure,
you know, just looking at feedback that has been given to them by the airplane systems. And what has that done to the modern pilot? It's kind of turned them into more of sort of reactionary in a way. They're sort of reacting to the stimuli that the machine is giving them. And it's more about how they work with each other. It's almost more of a business environment nowadays than it is a mechanical sort of hands-on piloting environment. And while he does, you know, note that these advancements in airplane design have really brought down the accident rate and made flying a lot safer, it's also changed the way that pilots interact with each other and with flying. And when crises do happen, they're almost less equipped to react to them. And just a really fascinating story. And anyone that's interested in aviation in any way would really find this a worthy article. So check that out. It was actually originally published in Vanity Fair magazine, and it's available on their website. So we'll drop a link into the show notes.
Very cool. Well, I think that just about does it, wouldn't you think?
I think so. As always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes for more details, and you can follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton. James is at J.E. Stacy, and follow the show at The Grey Nato. If you have any questions for us, please do write to thegreynato@gmail.com. And please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts, or grab the feed from thegreynato.com. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And until next time, we leave you this quote from Yvon Chouinard, the founder of Patagonia. The word adventure has gotten overused. For me, when everything goes wrong, that's when the adventure starts. Thank you.